The book of Ecclesiastes is a masterful book, in my opinion. It reminds us of life. It reminds us of our lives. It reminds us of this sin-infected world. And when I say that, I have to admit that I struggle with the idea of sin-infected world. It's true, but I struggle with it from the standpoint that there's a lot of pain that comes along with the fact that it is sin-infested. King Solomon has been teaching us this by one example after another example, or you could say it this way, an example upon example. And the reason that he's been giving us one example after another is to make us think about what's wrong with life. And in the process of giving these examples, he's focused on examples from our intellect, our emotions, our actions. And when he gives us examples related to our intellect, he's talking about wisdom. When he talks about emotions, he is actually talking about pleasure. When he talks about actions, he's talking about labor and work. And I thought it was interesting to realize that he's actually targeting those three areas. He's targeting our intellect, our emotions, our actions, the things that we do. And we've seen so far that that's exactly what he's been talking about now since chapter 1. He's been talking about wisdom and pleasure and labor. And he did this, I believe, to make us think about our own life. Man is characterized by intellect, emotion, and actions. Those are things that we experience. In other words, you interact with your world through wisdom. You interact with your world through pleasure. You interact with your world as you labor. And so those are things that we do. And with each of us, we interact differently in every area. And so each of us are different when it comes to intellect or emotions or actions. For some of us, we're more intellectual. For some of us, we have a greater desire for pleasure. For some of us, we are more of a doer than others. And so some of us are given to wisdom, and some of us are given to pleasure, and some of us are given more to doing things. And so in chapter 3 through chapter 6 of Ecclesiastes, Solomon explored pleasure. That was high on his list. In fact, in his introduction in chapters 1 and 2, he talked about pleasure first. And then the reason he did that is because that is really the most important thing, I think, from our perspective. Most of us seek pleasure. And life without pleasure is really disappointing. For example, in Ecclesiastes chapter 2, verse 24, he told us that there is nothing better for a man than to eat and drink and tell himself that his labor is good. And we have seen that conclusion repeated a number of times so far in this book. He keeps repeating that recommendation. It's obvious he wants us to get the message. In Ecclesiastes chapter 6, however, he comes along and says, but that's not guaranteed. In other words, the best thing in life is to experience pleasure, but it's not guaranteed. In chapter 7, he then starts talking about wisdom. And he mentioned wisdom in chapter 2. In chapter 2, he said that wisdom is better than being foolish. The wise were better than a fool. In chapter 7, he starts giving us examples of why wisdom is better than foolishness. He starts giving us a bunch of individual examples and how to recognize a wise person. For example, in verse 19, he says, wisdom strengthens a wise man more than 10 rulers. So the message is that wisdom is very important to us to help us get through life. In verse 23 and 25 of chapter 7, he said, I tested all this with wisdom. And I said, I will be wise, but it was far from me. So he says, I tested everything with wisdom. I want to be wise, he says. And then he says, but I can't. He says, it was far from me. So we're told in Scripture that he's the wisest man that has ever lived. Solomon tells us in verse 23 that he chased wisdom. Then he tells us at the end of the verse is that he couldn't realize the wisdom that he wanted to realize. In other words, you can't be a true wise person. In verse 27 and 28, he said, "Behold, I have discovered this," says the preacher, adding one thing to another to find an explanation which I'm still seeking but have not found. So the message is, he's been searching and he's looking and he says he's trying to find an explanation. He's still seeking, but he hasn't found it. Message is that with all of his wisdom, he could not solve the problem. I mean, it's really a disappointing chapter because he has been telling us there's great advantage to having wisdom, but you can't ever be a wise person. Just like he said about pleasure. He recommended pleasure above everything else, and then he says, but it's not guaranteed to you. And then he says, you really want wisdom. It's better than being a fool. But then he says, you can't really be a wise person. You can try. Verse 29, he says, "Behold, I have found only this." In other words, he says, the only thing I have really found, the only thing I can really bank on is that God made men upright and they have sought out many devices. In other words, God made man upright and men aren't upright. They're chasing a lot of evil devices, is his point. So that sets us up for our study this morning, which is Ecclesiastes chapter 8. And he's going to continue talking about wisdom. That's what he's going to be doing. And so, with verse 1 of chapter 8, he says this, "Who is like the wise man?" Still talking about the wise man. "And who knows the interpretation of a matter? A man's wisdom illuminates him, causes his stern face to beam." Now, he makes two comments in this verse. The first one we'll take first, obviously. And he says, "Who is like the wise man? And who knows the interpretation of a matter?" So he's been talking about a wise person in chapter 7. Some people actually say that verse 1 to chapter 8 belongs at the end of chapter 7 because he's dealing with a wise person in this verse. I don't think so. I guess it could belong there, but it doesn't need to be because in reality he is continuing to talk about a wise person all through this chapter. If you skim all the way down to the last verse, verse 17, and you look at the last sentence that talks about a wise man, and so he's talking about a wise man at the beginning of the chapter, at the end of the chapter, it's all through the chapter. He's continuing his discussion about a wise person. Probably the right answer would be is that there shouldn't be any chapter divisions. But anyway, that's we have a chapter division. So he says, "Who is like the wise man, and who knows the interpretation of a matter?" And the answer is what? Nobody. There is no one. Who is like the wise man? The answer is, there is no one. Nobody is really, truly a wise person. Scripture only tells us that Solomon is the wisest man that has ever lived. It doesn't say he was a wise man in the ultimate sense of wisdom. There's only one that's truly wise. If you were to check out Romans chapter 16, verse 27, it says the only wise God. So who's the person who's really truly wise? Only God. All of us come short. In James chapter 1, verse 5, we're told that if you lack wisdom, who should you pray to get wisdom? The answer is God. God's the source of wisdom. So if you want wisdom, you go to God, you ask for wisdom, He will help you. But in the process of helping you, that doesn't mean that you are a wise person. You are wiser, but you're not a wise person. And in Psalm 104, verse 24, we're told that God created the universe with wisdom. So Solomon says, who's like the wise man? And the implication is nobody. There is no one. Solomon was not wise. He said in verse 23 of chapter 7, "I will be wise," but it was far from me. I wanted to be wise, he says, but I couldn't get it. It was far from me. And so the message is he's never ever going to be truly a wise man. And there's never, ever going to really, truly be a wise woman. We're just wiser, just moving along, getting better at it, but we're never truly, ultimately wise. The last part of the verse, he says, a man's wisdom illumines him and causes his stern face to beam. What he's doing in the last part of this verse, telling you how to recognize a wise man or a wise woman. And the idea is that a wise person normally has a stern face. That fits, by the way, with the early part of chapter 7. If you remember, he said it's better to go to a house of mourning than to go to a house of feasting. In verse 4, he said the mind of the wise is in the house of mourning, and the mind of fools is in the house of pleasure, that is, they want to have fun. And so he says here that the man's wisdom illumines him. Normally, his face is stern. That is, a man who has wisdom, his face is normally stern. But it turns out that when a man gets wisdom, his face turns from being stern to a smile. Have you ever seen somebody? They're talking with you. They're trying to understand an issue. And all of a sudden, they understand. And what happens to their face? They smile. I've had that happen to me. I'm talking with somebody and they're struggling with an issue and finally they get it. All of a sudden it dawns on them what you're talking about and the smile breaks forth. I think that's what he's talking about. In other words, gets some wisdom, it helps him, and then his stern face turns into a smile. And so the first part of the verse he says, there isn't really truly a wise person, but you can tell when someone gains some wisdom, and when they gain some wisdom, their stern face turns into a smile. In verse 2, now he gives us a personal example. I believe that this is an example from his own life because he's going to talk about a king. And the purpose for giving us this example is to illustrate the message that he just gave us in verse 1. He's just told us that there's not really, truly a wise person. And so he's going to give us an example of wisdom. And he's going to tell us at the end that it's really tough to be a wise person. And the answer that he's going to give us is that you can't be a wise person. So the example is designed to give us that conclusion. So in verse 2, he says, I say, keep the command of the king because of the oath before God. So he says, keep the oath before God. Or we could translate it this way, is that, you have a king, remain loyal. I have to admit that I think loyalty is something that's missing in the lives of a lot of people. I think it's missing in the lives of a lot of people. We say one thing, if it suits our fancy, we change our mind. We just change our mind. No commitment. Our yes isn't yes. Our no isn't no. We say something, we don't mind changing it if it suits our fancy. That's okay. Let everybody else pick up the pieces. I say, keep the command of the king because of the oath before God. And you say, what oath? Well, if you go to chapter 5, verses 4 to 5, you find out that Solomon says that if you make a vow to God, you better keep it. God takes no delight in fools. And so here in verse 2, the message is that you make a commitment to the king, you better keep it. And so Solomon says that a wise person keeps a commitment to the king. Example of a wise person. A wise person makes a commitment, they keep their commitment. In fact, in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus said, let your yes be yes and your no be no. And I think that's the same idea that he has here. So the wise person, if you make a commitment, you follow through in your commitment, verse 3, and do not be in a hurry to leave him. He's giving us another recommendation. And he says, and do not join in an evil matter, for he will do whatever he pleases, talking about the king doing whatever he pleases. The first part of the verse, when he says, do not be in a hurry, the Hebrew word for hurry has the idea of terrified. Some of your Bibles, depending upon your translation, will actually say terrified or disturbed or hurried or quick. So the idea here is that they're hurrying because they're afraid. I think it's the LEB that actually says terrified. So you're standing before the king, and you're terrified something is happening. Maybe the king's confronting you, or you realize that the direction the king is going or the conversation you have is endangering you in some way. And he says, don't be in a hurry to leave. Ecclesiastes chapter 10, verse 4 says that if the king gets angry, remain calm. Here's what it says. If the ruler's temper arises against you, do not abandon your position because composure allays great offenses. So if you're confronted by the king, by a ruler, he's angry at you, don't fold. Stand your ground. Be calm, be patient. Keep your mouth shut is the idea. Don't hurry, don't leave. Last part of the verse is a very interesting little statement. He says, don't join in an evil matter. The word for evil is very interesting in the book of Ecclesiastes. I took some time this week to look at the term evil. Most of us, as soon as we read evil, we think sin, and I think that's the right idea. But all of his illustrations about evil are bad things that happen to us. All of them. All of the illustrations are about bad things that happen to us. For example, in Ecclesiastes chapter 5, verse 1, he says, go to church and listen. In verse 3 of chapter 5, he says, don't hoard wealth. In verse 16 of chapter 5, he says that as a person is born, so they die, and he calls that evil. In other words, you died just like you were born. You take nothing with you. You came in with nothing. You leave with nothing. He calls that an evil. In chapter 6, verse 1, he says, there is an evil which I've seen under the sun and is prevalent among men. God gives men riches and wealth and honor, and yet he can't enjoy the stuff that God gives them. He calls that an evil. So all of his examples about evil are things that impact us in a negative way. So it's the idea that you have a bad experience. And then he adds at the end of the verse, the king does whatever he wants. So the message is, don't do something that's going to be bad to the king. Don't join in an evil matter. That is, don't do something that's going to impact the king in a negative way. In other words, you want to keep the king happy. And I think that makes sense because he says, you better watch out. The king will do whatever he wants. You make him angry, you're going to get in trouble. Verse 4, since the word of the king is authoritative, who will say to him, what are you doing? And I think all he's done in verse 4 is continued his thought from the end of verse 3. So the message is that when you stand before a king, if he gets angry, hold your ground and don't join in some event or some activity that's going to make the king unhappy, that's going to be negative from his perspective because he's going to do whatever he wants and you can't stop him. And he's right. These are wise statements. What he's telling us is absolutely true. Verse 5, he who keeps a royal command experiences no trouble. The word for trouble in the New American Standard comes from a Hebrew word, evil. He's already been talking about evil, so he talks about evil again. I just thought it was interesting. It's translated as trouble. He says, so you don't experience any evil. That is, you don't experience a bad event in your life. Something bad will not happen to you, for a wise heart knows the proper time and procedure. And I want you to notice when he says, a wise heart knows the proper time and procedure. What is the message? The message is that a wise person, a wise man, or a wise woman knows the proper time and the proper procedure or method. I think I've already shared about a man that I knew in California. He was a very wise person from my perspective and from the perspective of many other people as well. We served on a board of elders together. And by consensus, he was one of the wisest men on the board. Not wise in the absolute sense, but he was a lot wiser. And one day he made the comment, in dealing with people, whether it's confronting people about their sin or working with people in a difficult situation, he said, we never seem to do it right. Always something goes wrong. And I think the reason that that happens is for two reasons. First of all, is that we're not wise enough. And you're going to see in a few verses here that he's going to expand on why we're not wise enough. We can't anticipate all the extenuating circumstances. We can't anticipate all the things that are going through this person's mind or all the possibilities of the things that are impacting them. And then the second part is that when people are hurt, boy, can they figure out ways to hurt you. They invent reasons to reject you, to criticize you. They're like politicians. I was thinking, they're like politicians. They invent ways to strike back. They become judgmental. They become unforgiving, driven by their emotions. And so Solomon says, there's a right time to, and there's a right way to do it. Verse 6, he says, for there is a proper time and procedure for every delight, though a man's trouble is heavy upon him. This is a very interesting statement in verse 6. He's giving us his first principle. I call it the first principle. We're going to get five principles total in this passage. There's a proper time and there's a proper method for everything, he says. That's a principle. That's a pretty important one. Proper time, proper method. Doesn't matter what it is you want. Doesn't matter what you're going to do. There's a proper time for everything. And he says, even if you're really weighed down, he says, though a man's trouble is heavy upon him. In other words, the message is that you're really struggling. Boy, is life the pits. You're really discouraged. You're really despondent. I mean, life is really bad. And he says, even then, he says, you need to pay attention. There is a proper time and there's a proper method for everything. That's wisdom. He's giving us wise advice. What he's doing is he's illustrating wisdom. And he used the king, I believe from his own personal life, about apparently some problem. Somebody came in before him. The implication, if you take verse 2, 3, and 4, and 5 all together, is that the person wasn't being faithful. They weren't being loyal. And somehow, there was an evil associated with it. It may be that the evil was connected with the lack of faithfulness or loyalty. And he's saying there's a proper time and there's a proper method for everything. And it may be that what he's talking about is a guy who is standing before the king who is in a panic and wanting to leave, and he says there's a proper time and a proper method for how you respond for everything in life. I think that's what he's saying. A very interesting passage. I think most of us have been taught at some point that if you are in an argument, what are you supposed to do? Zip your lip, be quiet. Take a little time to cool down. Think about how to respond to the person and then go and engage them and try to deal with the issue. Right? That's the proper time. It's the proper method. Where did they learn it? They learned it, I believe, from Solomon. They may not think that they did, or at least, if nothing else, they were as wise as Solomon at that point, making that recommendation. Verse 7. If no one knows what will happen, who can tell him what will happen? Who can tell him when it will happen? So he says in verse 7, there's another problem with this. There is a proper time and there's a proper method, but you don't know whether or not your method's going to work out right. So the message is that, yes, there's wisdom in the right time, there's wisdom in the right method, but you don't know what's going to happen. You don't know how it's going to impact the person. Reminds me of the wise man I just told you about. He said, we never seem to get it right. Everything we do always seems to come out wrong. And he was correct. We were thinking about a number of things that involved the lives of other people, and it didn't matter who it was, everybody got upset. It didn't matter what you said or what you did. I think it's a commentary on people. Also a commentary on lack of wisdom. Nobody has the ultimate wisdom, and you can't anticipate all of the what-ifs in life. You have no idea what's going to happen to tomorrow. If you did, you probably would have approached the problem in a different way. So he says, it's great to be wise, but there's some real problems with wisdom. You're not ultimately wise. That's really what he's telling us. So his first principle is that there's a proper time and method for everything, but you don't know enough to anticipate all of the problems that are associated with your decisions of what you're going to do. Verse 8. Verse 8 now is an important little statement. He says, even if you were able to anticipate everything, he says, no man has authority to restrain the wind with the wind. That's an interesting idea, that you're going to take the wind and restrain the wind. Or authority over one's day of death and you don't. And there's no discharge in the time of war. The idea is that you can't get dismissed in the middle of war. Apparently in his day, in our day you can. And evil will not deliver those who practice it. So he says, even if you did know how tomorrow is going to work out, you can't change it. And at the end of the verse, he says, even if you decided to try to change it by doing evil, that's not going to help you either. And I think that maybe what he's talking about at the very end is something that I've struggled with over the years, and I know that some of you have as well, and that is that you're thinking about obeying God. God has told us to do something, and all of a sudden it dawns on you that if you follow this biblical principle, that you actually might make things worse in your relationship with someone else. In other words, something evil is going to happen to you, evil in the way that Solomon defines evil. That is, something bad happens to you. And so you might think that, well, what I ought to do is not do what God tells me to do. I'm going to go ahead and do evil to avoid evil. And I think that's probably what he's saying at the end of verse 8. It says, evil won't deliver those who practice it. So if you're not going to follow biblical principles, it's not going to help you either, verse 9. Now he gives us a conclusion. A conclusion, a major conclusion of the section. He says, all this I have seen and applied my mind to every deed that has been done under the sun, wherein a man has authority over another man to his hurt. He's been talking about oppression. He's been talking about one bad thing happening to another person. He calls it oppression, where a person exercises authority over another. He says, I've looked at all of these things. This is what I've been communicating to you. I've been trying to remind you of what life is all about, and I'm trying to give you a recommendation. That's the message of verse 9. In verse 10, 11, 12, 13, he now gives us a number of examples. He says in verse 10, so then I have seen the wicked buried. Those who used to go in and out of the holy place, try church. The holy place would be the holy place in the tabernacle or in the temple. He says, and they are soon forgotten in the city where they did this. He said, this too is futility. I have to admit, as I was thinking about this verse, I was thinking about my own experience with burying people. Not that I physically buried them. I had the memorial service, or some people would say the funeral service. And I'll tell you, I had a lot of people come to me and they're talking to me about their loved one that has died and they want me to do the service, and they tell me that the person they believe is going to heaven, put their faith in Jesus Christ at some point, but they haven't been going to church all these years. But I know that they're going to heaven. So when you do your service, would you just tell everybody that they're going to heaven? All of a sudden I'm going, wow, this is a problem. If they've never ever professed faith in Jesus Christ, I have a major issue. Scripture tells me that they're not going to heaven if they've never put their faith in Jesus Christ. But they want me to do that. This verse says, I have seen the wicked. They used to go to church, and then they're forgotten. The word forgotten is a very, very unusual Hebrew word. It turns out that probably a better translation is not forgotten, but praised. In other words, they're praised. in the city. I mean, they were wicked, but yet they get this accolades about how wonderful they were at the memorial service. And the reason we believe that the word probably should be praised is that the number of very good medieval Hebrew manuscripts and some Greek versions, in fact, almost every one of the modern translations, be it ESV or the Holman Christian Standard Bible or the LEB or the NET Bible, all translated as praised. So here's the picture. This person is really a wicked person. I would say probably not a true Christian. And what happens? They get praised at the memorial service. I have yet to conduct a memorial service and have anybody say that the person was a wicked person. Everybody praises the person who's died. Have you ever gone to a funeral service, memorial service, and had someone say bad things about the person? I'd be surprised if anybody can tell me that. People want to say positive things about the person no matter how evil they were. It happens all the time in Washington. It happens all the time around the world. So the message of verse 10 would be is that a wise person doesn't praise a wicked person if they've been buried. This is a problem with the lack of wisdom. The person who praises a wicked person doesn't have wisdom. Verse 11. Verse 11 is another example of a lack of wisdom. It says, because the sentence against an evil deed is not executed quickly, which is very common in our culture, therefore the hearts of sons among them are given fully to do evil. What's the message here? The message here is that evil grows like a weed in the spring when the sentence against an evil deed is delayed. This isn't talking about capital punishment. This means that justice in the court system is delayed. And this is so common. People end up committing a crime and then they wait years and years and years before the court trial. So common. Not to mention the absence of capital punishment. All that does is it makes it worse in our culture. Another example of lack of wisdom. Verse 12 is another example. He says, although a sinner does evil 100 times and may lengthen his life, still I know that it will be well for those who fear God, who fear him openly. Now, Solomon has already told us in the Proverbs that the evil is not going to increase his life. And here he admits that there are occasions when a person is evil, and yet they may actually lengthen their life. And he sees this as a problem. In other words, there's a sinner, he does evil, and he lengthens his life, and this is wrong, he says. And so he adds very quickly, he says, still I know it will be well with those who fear God, who fear him openly. This is an important statement. He says it's best to fear God openly. Doesn't matter what's going on in the world. Doesn't matter whether sin seems to win, whether evil seems to win. It's still best to fear God. Verse 13, but it will not be well for the evil man, and he will not lengthen his days like a shadow because he does not fear God. So Solomon's struggling with wisdom. He's struggling with inconsistencies in life. And his conclusion is, yes, there's a lack of wisdom here, and there's a lack of wisdom here, and I see this wrong, and I see this evil, and I'm trying to be wise, and I'm trying to figure out how all this stuff works together, and I really can't figure it all out. And he says, and yet I know that what's really best is that you fear God. And he says, that's bottom line. So the second recommendation in 13 is that you need to fear God. Okay, verse 14 says, there is a futility which is done on the earth. That is, there are righteous men to whom it happens according to the deeds of the wicked. On the other hand, there are wicked men to whom it happens according to the deeds of the righteous. I say that this too is futility. Same message he sent us in chapter 7, verse 15. He says there are bad things that happen to the righteous, It shouldn't happen. There are good things that happen to the wicked men. It shouldn't happen. He said, this is all wrong. This is empty. This is futility. This is backwards, is what he's saying. That's sad. He said, life under the sun's broken. Or I could add, life is all messed up. Everything's broken. Life's upside down. He sees that life doesn't work like it should, at least like he thinks it should. So, verse 15, recommendation. This is the next recommendation, the fourth one. He says, so I commended pleasure. I mean, we've seen that already in chapter 2, verse 24, chapter 3, verse 22, chapter 5, verse 18. He says, so I commended pleasure, for there is nothing good for a man under the sun except to eat and to drink and to be merry. And this will stand by him in his toils. Notice the word toils. That's the struggles and trials of life. Throughout the days of his life, which God has given him under the sun. This is life under the sun. His comment is really simple. What he's talking about is that pleasure helps us by numbing the pains of life. That's it. His recommendation is, have fun. It helps you through the difficult evils of life. For a Christian, this doesn't sound right. I mean, there is an element of the truth in this passage that's good, and that is that God does enable us to enjoy things we eat and drink and does help us to enjoy labor. I mean, that's true. God designed our mouths. God designed food to enjoy. I mean, that's true. But Solomon's recommendation is one of what else is left in this messed up world. That's really what he's saying. In other words, life is so messed up, just have fun. That's the best you can do. He already told us in chapter 2 that this was the best recommendation that he had for us. So wisdom doesn't do it. He's already told us that pleasure is the best, but not guaranteed. So verse 16, last recommendations about wisdom. He says, when I gave my heart to know wisdom and to seek the task which has been done on the earth, even though one should never sleep day or night, and that is the idea that you don't sleep day or night trying to figure it out, and I saw every work of God, I concluded that man cannot discover the work which has been done under the sun. And even though man should seek laboriously, that is, work really hard, he cannot discover. And even though the wise man should say, I know, he cannot discover. Does that sound like a repeat of chapter 7? So, he's already told us that pleasure is the best. It numbs your pain to help you get through life. And he says, but it's not guaranteed. And now he tells you that wisdom is really important. It's better than being a fool, but you can't be a true wise person. You can seek it and try to be extremely wise, but you're not going to get there. And that's the end of chapter 8. Now, I don't know about you, but when I finished looking at chapter 8, it was a little disappointing. Wisdom is better, but you can never be truly wise. Almost like give up on life. Well, I would like to say this. What Solomon is trying to tell us is that life under the sun is broken. It's broken when it comes to intellect. It's broken when it comes to emotions. And then the next part of Ecclesiastes is going to tell us that when it comes to labor, life's broken too. He's just going through every aspect of human life. Your intellect, your emotions, and now your actions. That's what comes up next, coming up in chapter 10. He's going to finish up in chapter 9 with a little bit of wisdom, then he's going to shift into talking about labor. So the question is, how do we respond to this? Well, I have two responses for you. First of all, the fact that life doesn't work right is oppressive. He's been talking about oppression since chapter 3. Either God's oppressive or somebody's oppressive, and you're suffering. You're experiencing the evil. And a wise man, he says, sees the oppression and he gets angry. And I have to admit, as I've gone through Ecclesiastes, on a couple of occasions I've gotten really upset because I realize that what he's talking about is real, is true. This is life. The second way to respond is to rejoice. Now you might say, those don't go together. Yes, they do. Because it helps us understand what we're seeing in life. In Proverbs, he tells us that the wicked man is not going to lengthen his life by being wicked. Ecclesiastes says, but there's exceptions. And he's right, there are exceptions. And that helps us understand that what we see in life is right. Let's make it personal. You could be a righteous person, and you're doing everything that God has asked you to do, and yet something bad can happen to you. Has that ever happened? That doesn't mean that God's not faithful. That explains what's happening here on planet Earth. This planet's messed up. And why is it messed up? Here are some reasons it's messed up. First of all, everybody in this room and everybody around the world is a sinner. In Jeremiah chapter 17, verse 9, it tells us that we are wicked people and you deceive yourself. And other people deceive you. In 1 John chapter 5, verse 19, it tells us that the whole world lies in the control of Satan. Talks about the world, cosmos, world system. The whole world system is under the control of Satan. He's the god of the world, god of this age. And in 1 John chapter 2, verses 15 to 17, I'm going to read it. It tells us that the whole world system is after pleasure. I mean, that's the characteristic of our world system. It's about pleasure. Lust of the eyes, lust of the flesh, and the pride of life, which is actually a motivation on the inside. It says, for all that's in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, the boastful pride of life, notice the part boastful, that's an emotion, is not from the Father, but is from the world. Now listen to what it says. The world is passing away, and also its lusts, but the one who does the will of God lives forever. Does that sound like Solomon? He says he knows it's going to go well with those who fear God, right? You look at the world, it's all messed up, but fear God. 1 John chapter 2, verse 17 says, do the will of God. Same idea. That, to me, gives me direction in life. Solomon is all frustrated, I believe. And what he does is he gives us recommendations of how to proceed in life. Same message, 1 John chapter 2, verse 17. Let's pray.